Welcome back, everybody. This is John Milanka with United Patients Group. Be informed and be well. We have two special guests today, actually. We have Claudia Morandi, as well as Beth Dost, who you've seen on our show a few times. She's been a friend of United Patients Group, a friend of Corinne and I, and we've done a lot together. So thanks for being on. And we're going to be talking about pain. And this is a big subject. Not only here in the U.S., but around the globe. And we have two specialists. The first one is Claudia Morandi. I won't mention your name, Claudia, how about that? But she's the founder of the National Don't Punish Pain Rally Organization. Claudia, a retired court reporter, self-published author, is from East Providence, Rhode Island. As a person living with severe Crohn's disease since a child, she witnessed firsthand the challenges a person with pain encounters when trying to obtain adequate pain management. Claudia, in 2017, created a Don't Punish Pain Rally organization focusing on organizing protest rallies throughout the country for people with pain who could no longer access pain management due to the 2016 CDC opioid prescription guidelines. She started with 5 members. Today, there's 1,000 members. Congratulations for that across the country. There's chapters in Canada, Australia, as well as the UK. And today, Claudia works with doctors throughout the country who have been targeted unfairly by governmental agencies and medical boards. She can be reached at cmorandi1@cox.net, and I'll put all that information in there as well. And then you've also authored a few books, Dottie on the Potty by Claudia Morandi, and Crohn's, the other C word, Crohn's Disease, Court Reporting, and Custody Battles. Welcome, Claudia, and I'll also do Beth's intro. Beth Dost, she is an RN, a senior healthcare consultant, who was the first nurse to stand for the humanitarian use of medical marijuana in 2012 in Massachusetts. She is the clinical director of the Massachusetts Patients Advocacy Alliance, MPAA, which promoted the medical marijuana bill. Beth, a former oncology, ICU, ER, home care, and hospice executive, currently advocates publicly for safe access to cannabis for those who suffer and have been marginalized. She's been featured locally and on numerous national broadcast mediums. She expanded her advocacy work, focusing on cannabis therapeutics, educating and policy creation while raising awareness of the abandonment of pain patients who rely on prescribed opioids and the attack on the doctors who care for them. In 2000, Beth was diagnosed with 3 chronic pain conditions, thus joining the approximately 50 million Americans who chronically suffer. Since 2008, she's been treated by 13 physicians for intractable pain, one of only about 17 million intractable pain sufferers. Her experiences of being stigmatized and decriminalized against in her quest for adequate pain control has galvanized her resolve to help, and she speaks openly about the state of suffering in America. Beth was awarded the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year in healthcare and is a member of their entire alumni group. Woo! That was a lot to take in, ladies and gentlemen. How are you doing, both of you?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, being on the show here, ladies. And let's talk about pain. And so you both have experienced pain with your patients, but for yourself. And let's talk about what's going on in the U.S. right now, you know, because a lot of doctors are under the, the microscope of how many prescriptions they can write and what what the government has from it. What just happened last week was a friend of mine's brother just passed away because his doctor stopped writing opioids for his pain. And he went to the street and led to
death. Right.
And so it's sad because the family's like, he was an addict. He wasn't a homeless gentleman. I mean, you have this image of an addict, of a homeless person in the alley, stealing, felon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the outcome could have been solved, could have been helped. And so can you talk about what you have been experiencing, Claudia, which brought you into this industry, I guess, and why sure. you're an advocate and why you're the voice for millions and millions of people?
Right. So I lived in a hospital for about 10 years on and off. I raised my children from there. I ran my business from there, fought a custody battle. I have severe Crohn's disease, and I've had it since I was about 4 or 5 years old. I think probably 7 years ago, I started to hear the term drug seeker. And I live in the smallest state in the country. And whenever I was at the hospital, which was usually every 2 weeks, I would get admitted. I always had an advocate with me, my mom. And she looked at me, she says, oh my gosh, she's like, you need to have legislation regarding this because you're treated like a criminal. So that's what I did. I went on social media, 2017, and I said, I'm gonna organize a national protest for pain patients. I started with 5 members, there's over 10,000. And the response has been like so sad because there's millions that don't know about us and we need to bring awareness. Just a brief synopsis, why are we here? So we have anti-opioid crusaders in the country. One is Andrew Kolodny, and they're not even pain management doctors, and they've created this organization called PROP. And PROP helped create those 2016 CDC guidelines in secret from the FDA. They approached the FDA, and the FDA said, no way, we're not going to put any arbitrary limit on how much pain medication a person needs, but the CDC did so. Once those CDC guidelines went into effect, many states actually turned them into laws, regulations, and they were grossly misapplied, misinterpreted, and they were really intended for primary care physicians. But there was so much confusion, and with the confusion came the DEA targeting doctors, because it was just a great way to, you know, latch onto low-hanging fruit. And instead of the DEA focusing on the real culprit, heroin, illicit fentanyl, they went after pain management physicians. Fast forward 4 years later, thousands of suicides, thousands more of legitimate pain patients who hit the street in a desperate attempt to live a pain-free life. And the sad thing about this is we have, I think, 9,000 deaths associated with overdoses. But when a doctor loses a patient, the government has taken it upon themselves to call it an overdose. So if somebody has a heart attack and they have an opiate in their system, it's going down as an overdose because that's revenue. So anti-opioid crusaders have essentially created the opioid crisis because we're now driving up our overdose rates. And prescribing is at an all-time low since 2011, and overdosing is at an all-time high. So pain patients have become collateral damage. By the time doctors find me, they're broken. They've been targeted by the unscrupulous DEA. When they'll usually plead because they're doctors, not lawyers, they're afraid. And the DEA, breaks down the doctor's door in the clinic, terrorizes these doctors. They're robbed of their medical license, their DEA certificate. They can no longer prescribe. The patients become collateral damage. The attorney generals make money seizing their assets. And there's one message right now, and the anti-opioid crusaders are just pushing for our country to be an opioid-free country unless the person can take buprenorphine, Suboxone. And it's just a disgusting, vile attack on the pain patient. My patients, they're elderly. They have rare disease. They have advanced stage cancer. My veterans don't have limbs. And the cruelest form that's been brought to the country because of those 2016 CDC guidelines, which I'm confident will be rewritten, hopefully in a better light. Patients have been forced to choose their benzodiazepine or their opiates, and you can absolutely take both safely. The reason we're here is because of hateful anti-opioid crusaders. I'm a mom to 2 teenagers, so I'm all too familiar with what I don't want my child to do. And of course, I would never want my child to get their hands on opiates, but They're going to be informed on the issue. All of this work that we've poured into the fake opioid crisis, our overdose rates are sky high, and we ain't seen nothing yet, because over the next 6 months post-COVID, it's going to get much worse.
Do you think with pain and also, you know, my fear with a lot of patients that I've spoken to on a regular basis that are in the midst of COVID, depression is seeking in, and they're talking to their doctors about it, you know, other medications for that as well, and that, which is another type of pain, you know, you have pain of going down the rabbit hole. Grief is another one too. So Beth, you're a pain patient, or you're a pain advocate, I should say. And you've been on the show quite a few times talking about pain. And so can you add to that? Because you work with a lot of pain patients. And I love what you're talking about, Claudia. I didn't realize that you work with the doctors and you really fight for the doctors to stand up for them. Because a lot of times doctors don't have time, one, but also, you know what to do with the next step. And when you get threatened that your medical license is going to be yanked, I mean, that's a major threat.
John, we have doctors in prison 40 years. We have doctors in prison 20 years. I just want to add one thing, John, if I could, before Beth speaks, because I'm going through menopause and I don't want to lose this train of thought.
Well, you can speak as long as you want. Go ahead.
I just want to take John through the life of a pain patient, because Beth is going through this right now. There's the life of a pain patient. First, you have to find a doctor who's willing to prescribe. You have about a 30% chance in our country today of finding a doctor who's going to prescribe. Now, most patients white knuckle it, driving to their pain management visit because they're not sure, is this the day I get cut off? When you get to your pain management visit, you'll be seen by a random anesthesiologist one time, and then you'll be seen by a nurse practitioner, a PA who doesn't know your history. You're going to be subjected to a urine drug screen. In that urine drug screen, if they ever find cannabis in your system, you're booted. No THC, no CBD. Some pain management facilities will not allow you to take melatonin. No kratom, nothing that's plant-based is accepted. If you fail your urine drug screen, you're booted, you'll never get back in, and it's you're tarnished. If you're fortunate to find a doctor, you have zero problems with your urine drug screens, which are 70% prone to human error. When you drive to the pharmacy, you have a 50% chance that the pharmacist is going to fill or not fill. The reason they may not fill is it's because it's above the 90 daily morphine equivalent. Because the CDC, in their not infinite wisdom, put an arbitrary limit on how much pain medication a person should receive. Once again, that goes back to Andrew Kolodny, Anna Lemke, all of the anti-opioid crusaders whose one goal, and they've been very successful because they've bamboozled the country, is to, they attack pain patients in an effort to heal their pain of a loss. Once you get to the pharmacy, your pharmacist will say, yes, I'm filling. No, I'm not filling. But this is probably one of the grossest things that's happening to patients, is the pharmacist will tell you, you need to fill another script. Well, what do you mean? I only need one script to be filled. No. The DEA says, wait a minute, who's the DEA? Because if you're an elderly person, you don't know who the DEA is. But the pharmacist will say, you need to fill not one, but three non-opioid scripts. So now you're going to have unused scripts littered around your house, which is dangerous, right? What if somebody gets their hands on those scripts? You're going to incur maybe $600-$700 extra monthly. But these are desperate people. My veterans don't have limbs, and this is what they're being subjected to. Now, if your pharmacist will agree to fill it, don't worry, chances are your insurance carrier will not cover opiates. This all goes back to those grossly misapplied, misinterpreted CDC guidelines that were created with the help of anti-opioid zealots who are making hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars by promoting Suboxone, buprenorphine. It's all about the money. At the end of the day, we've had 9,000 overdoses a year since 1999, but yet in 2017, we had 488,000 alcohol-related accidents. we have an overdosing problem, but it ain't from swallowing pain pills. It's from illicit fentanyl and heroin. But I just wanted to take you through the joyous life of a pain patient.
You brought back some memories, what Corinne and I went through. You know, I remember we spent a day down in Stanford University at the oncologist, Friday afternoon. Normally an hour ride, it was 2.5 hours because we got out of there at 5:30. So we were in bumper to bumper and she was in so much pain. We get back home, I go to our CVS pharmacy and they would not, we sat there for a good 2 hours because they wouldn't fill it because she had already had I think it was 5 milligram narcotic that was already prescribed. And they said, no, it's not the 30 days. I just sat there and it's like, my wife needs those. And I pleaded with the pharmacist, tears in my eyes after going through what we went through. And I said, you know, she needs this. And they ended up filling it, but it took me everything. And I went back after she passed, I went back and shared, just thank you for listening to me and not, and I guess thinking outside the box or going around the law, if you want to say. Sorry, Beth, you're still here, right?
Sorry, Beth, I didn't mean to do that. But can I share, there's a slice of hope. After 19 months of working with lawyers, we are filing a class action lawsuit against large chain pharmacies in my home state of Rhode Island. This insanity will stop. This is referred to as the pain patient genocide. Those CDC guidelines specified, these CDC guidelines will not affect cancer patients or sickle cell. They affect everybody now. Only the privileged receive pain medication. It's disgusting. It's the most abrasive, disgusting attack on the disabled community, the most vulnerable community in the country, and it's going to stop. And I'll tell you what, if I have to run for Congress in 2 years, I'll run because I'm going to start snagging up people's seats at this point because I'm in Rhode Island. So I can just go knocking on doors at this point. It's got to stop.
The smallest state in the union. Yeah. Is that what it is?
The biggest little state in the union.
Yeah. Yeah. And Beth, sorry. I know you're here, Beth.
I was going to say, what Claudia said about the pain patient experience, rinse and repeat, because it's every 30 days. It's not you go there, you see your doctor annually, and then you get your scripts renewed. Oh, no. No one calls you to renew an opiate. No one calls you. But they'll call you ad nauseum to renew, like, lisinopril. You know, my father will have buckets of lisinopril, but you know, for his high blood pressure. But no one. So it's every 30 days pain patients go through this once again. And these patients can have years worth of long-standing history of very good compliance and good pain relief. And now all of a sudden, they're living in terror as their physicians are forced tapering them down off their opiates, which is sinful.
You mentioned living in terror, but you know, I've worked with patients that, like you said, Claudia, 50% of the time they're driving down there. Are they going to fill it?
Yeah.
Or are they not going to fill it? No. Or they'll say, you know, you have your script that will say for 30 pills and the pharmacist refuses to fill that. We need a lower amount. And so the doctor will say 29. And they said, no, we're not, we meant 10, not 29. When we say fewer. And so, what's happening right now with what you're going through? I know you're doing a lot. Are you working with your local state governments? What can you recommend for patients that are going through this that are watching this show right now?
So I have legislation that's passed the House unanimously, just basically stating chronic intractable pain patients need opiates. And, you know, a version of my bill has been carried into, I think, 6 or 7 other states. And that was the goal when I created this legislation. But not everybody lives in the smallest state. So it's hard to get down to your state house. But nobody was willing to cover the plight of the pain patient because of those hateful anti-opioid crusaders. They'll say, well, the reason that they're, you know, they're in pain is because they're hooked on their drugs. So that the anti-opioid crusader, such as PROP, you know, they've not only exposed people who have lost loved ones, they'll use them as pawns to attack pain patients. What you can do is first join the Facebook page, Don't Punish Pain Rally. We protest again on October 7th and constantly hound your federal senators. All federal senators are aware of the issue. Now, your local representatives, some of them, you know, they sell cars during the day and they practice medicine at nighttime. They don't know this is happening unless they're affected. I think what I had going for me is I started to advocate for local lawmakers. Not everybody, well, nobody does. I'm the only person in the country who does what I do. I take people to pain management. I accompany them to the pharmacy. And I can tell you what, when I'm in the room, the nurse practitioner or the PA or the doctor always seem to take on a different tone when I'm in the room. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I wouldn't be prescribing in this day and age because the medical board keeps track of every pill that is dispensed. What the medical boards do is they print out the highest prescribers and then they hand it off to the DEA. And that's how these raids start. So the DEA knocks on the doctor's door, terrorizes the patients. They're in SWAT gear, weapons drawn, and the patients, they're like, oh my God, what's happening? And the doctors, sometimes the doctors will usually know this is going to happen because they'll get alerted from a pharmacy. But the two tools that were created to protect the doctor are actually used against the doctor. And one is those urine drug screens and the other is the PDMP. It's going to take a while to ever eliminate those because...
And it's embarrassing for the doctors. When Corinne and I were battling her cancer, we went to our doctor up here in the Bay Area recommended an American doctor who's been down in Mexico for the last 18 years. And they said, I think you should go down. And I said, come on, I'm not going to be that husband that takes his wife down to Mexico. And
we
did it. And I would do it again. And he was just tired of constantly getting raided, spending all his time in court and winning. And he said, you know what? Forget this. I'm moving down there. And if they want, Americans want to come down. And we went down to his clinic, professional, clean. And you had patients from all over the world, not only South America, Asians, Europeans, Americans, U.S. Athletes, on his wall. I mean, he was just tired of doing this. You made a point earlier about lawmakers don't know unless they're affected. And it's the same thing in the cannabis industry. You know, cancer will unfortunately affect us all in some way. If it's, God forbid, us, a loved one, a spouse, you know, it will. I hope no one has to be in that position, but I don't want to say it's life, but you know, pain, cannabis with Corinne did not work with her pain. Really bummed me and her out because, like, God, we've been advocates. And I share with patients all the time on our show is I don't want people to think cannabis is the golden pill, the golden ticket that will help. And I never heard to use the word cure that will help everything. And it worked with my father-in-law, but it didn't work with her in regards to pain or attacking her cancer cells. She didn't want pain pills because it didn't make her feel good. So what do you say for patients? Let's take the other side. So what if you have the doctor or those other advocacy groups that have lost a loved one with pain pills and say, you know, ban all opioids. It's bad, bad, bad. You must get that.
You know, actually I don't because, I think an educated person who lost a loved one to an overdose, chances are their loved one struggled with addiction. Let's face it, if you're an addict, you're probably predisposed to addiction. And I'm sure there was not all the time because some people just get hooked on pain pills and that's just the way it is. But we find and research will prove over and over and over again, if there was an underlying condition with addiction, it started when they were younger. And a lot of senators, a lot of my Southern senators believe that cannabis is the gateway drug. I don't buy that. I think if you're predisposed to addiction, you're going to struggle with a food addiction, an alcohol addiction, an opioid addiction, a sex addiction. Like, hey, I don't know about that. That's okay. But it's not common to meet somebody and when they say, oh my gosh, my son took one Vicodin and he went right to the street and he got his hands on heroin.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. You know, and the fact that these anti-opioid crusaders, they profit off of people who lost loved ones to addiction, and addiction tears the family apart. It is a debilitating illness, but so is Crohn's disease. So, yeah,
which you went through as well. Let's talk about what is your definition of pain management? Or Beth, how about you? What's your definition of pain management? Because we've talked about this of pain management and the importance of a pharmaceutical, but also importance of combination. Can you talk about the benefits in combining cannabis with a pharmaceutical, a pain med?
Well, so we always talk about combining pharmaceuticals with cannabis, and usually in the hope that people can wean themselves down a little bit off their pain medication. Usually it's an opiate. However, as Claudia just stated, and you stated, John, and I've stated multiple times, we've been to conferences where we have seen the isolates. People have been able to isolate the various components of the plant, and it really does not show any action against severe, chronic, intractable pain. But cannabis can have, especially depending on people, their endocannabinoid system, their receptor fill when they take plant-based cannabis to enhance their and flush their endocannabinoid system within their receptors. They can have a feeling of overall wellness, and they can also have better sleep. And so people like that. People that enjoy getting mildly intoxicated and that makes them feel good, that can also help their experience of pain. But as Claudia said, if you're getting kicked out, if you take opiates and cannabis, and then cannabis is when it shows up in your urine screen, and then you can't get your opiates anymore, you're not going to be very happy, because that cannabis is not going to take care of your pain the way an opiate does. There is nothing like an opiate to take care of chronic, severe, and often intractable pain. And this is not just chronic pain patients that we're talking about. We are seeing the spillover now into post-surgical patients. We're seeing the spillover into post-accident patients. In my family, a family member had an accident. A lot of damage to his face, and he was sent home with 4 5-milligram Vicodin. That lasted him through about, I want to say maybe 10 hours, because...
So that's not a lot, is what you're saying.
4 is very small, 5 milligrams is very small, and not every opiate is created equal. So the gold standard in opiate care, an opiate, if you were to look at opiates, the gold standard is morphine. So that's why it's morphine equivalents. That's why the CDC guidelines are 100 morphine milligram equivalents. Then everything else is can be put up against the efficacy of morphine. So dilaudid and fentanyl are stronger than morphine. Very clean, metabolized with very little metabolites. People get very good pain relief from them. Fentanyl is dispensed in micrograms, like a thousandth of a gram, like smaller than a hundredth of a milligram. They're very, very small doses. And you'll see here people will take 25 mic or 10 mic patches, and they put them on an area that has fat, and it's a slow release of fentanyl. And then they're also prescribed, if their doctor is skilled at pain medication, which most of these doctors are that have gotten in trouble, they're often prescribed a breakthrough. And a lot of times that's oxycodone, which is pure Percocet. Oxycontin is slow-release Percocet. And what addicts like to do with oxycontin is chew it, because then they get that full-on 12-hour effect very quickly. And that's what happened. But one of the things that we talk about in the change, pain used to be the fifth vital sign. And that's because in multiple studies, people that didn't have a voice, especially hospitalized patients that had experienced extreme pain or conditions or surgeries, people that didn't have a voice, including children, were under-medicated for pain against their peers that could express that they were having pain. And so if you look at then the fentanyls, the Dilaudid, the morphines, then you have typically the Oxycontin, Percocet, Percodan. That just means that it's a combination therapy. One has Tylenol, one has aspirin. And then you look at the Vicodins. They're sort of like, you have Vicodin, Vicoprofen, one has Motrin, one has Tylenol. And then like the codeine kind of come down below that. But people are, codeine has a great, great action against coughing. So it suppresses coughs. That's why it's in cough medicine. So people are coughing their heads out. Now they have they're coughing their brains out. They have, you know, they have a respiratory virus going around the country. And if you can't get relief from that, so you're up all night. I don't know how that's good for you. People get, you know, headaches and fevers. And, you know, you have codeine could be prescribed. It used to always be in cough syrups. And I can remember having old cough syrups because so few people with pain actually become addicted to opiates that most people just self. You've all heard the stories about the kids that have gotten 4 wisdom teeth pulled. By the way, that can be, if they're impacted, that's a big surgery in your mouth. They get sent home with typically Vicodin, and they might have maybe they take it for 2 days, and then they say, you know what, I don't really like the way this feels anymore, and then you've got Vicodin. So when they called back unused opiates, the government called them back. They said, we're going to have a take-back day. Wasn't it 6,000 tons? Was like some massive amount of opiates. It was 6,000 pounds or tons nationwide. People turn them into their most. So obviously, most people take their opiates responsibly. But there's a pathophysiology to pain. So short-term pain, that's acute. If it goes into a chronic more than 3 months, if it lasts more, and you don't get on that, and it lasts more than 6 months, you're probably going to be in pain for the rest of your life. You're probably going to be in pain because the body gets very smart. And pain, where does pain occur? In the brain. That's where the receptors are. And so if you were to touch a hot stove, you'd get that, you'd get boom, it would be hot. You'd notice you pull your hand away because that whole signal goes up, goes through the great horn of the spinal cord up to your brain. You perceive it, boom, you take it. Now, if you're constantly bombarded with pain, chronic pain, constant, the body gets really smart. It's sort of like laying down another highway on a very high traffic freeway. And so the body starts laying down more receptors to receive the pain because you're overwhelming the brain. So that's always been the goal, is to cut off the reception of pain. So you'll see a pain patient that's totally incapacitated. They take the right dose of an opiate, within an hour, they can get up and do laundry. It's as long as they don't have any other physical. I have invisible pain, so people don't know I have it unless I tell them. Claudia, she has invisible pain. You wouldn't know Claudia had pain unless she told you she had pain. So there are a lot of people walking around that we don't see, that we don't know have chronic pain. And so I always say they're great pretenders at all. And if we look at, which is what I said, if we look at Primo Levi, who was a Holocaust survivor and poet and just an exemplary man, wrote that if we know that there is pain, if we know that there is suffering and we do nothing to alleviate it, we ourselves become the tormentors. And this country, it's against the World Health Organization, and it's even against, it's a war crime to allow people to suffer like this. And yet it goes on every day in a civilized country in very specific ways. Pharmacists have been empowered, and they override the physician, and the physician is being disempowered. And I just heard a report that in 10 years we're not going to have any internists. Yeah. Why become a physician?
Hospice nurse and talking about pain and end of life, I mean, they're okay with that. Take as much as you want, more. And I personally think that's human euthanizing.
Actually, they're not anymore. That's also an issue. They're starting to have trouble getting opiates for hospice pain. So this is not just it's going to affect everybody soon. And when I was with Claudia, I had the privilege of being with Claudia in front of the Rhode Island legislature. And in particular, we had a patient there that suffered from severe, very rare Ehlers-Danlos, which they subluxate, they can dislocate, they have very loose ligaments, and they can dislocate. They can roll over, they dislocate their shoulder. It's extremely painful. So when she got up and she described her life, and she said that she had to save in pain medication because she had been tapered to take so she could testify.
Yeah.
All the legislators were like this. Because they just don't know.
Yeah.
One of these things you don't really know until it happens to you. But this is something that you don't want to have to.
No. So Claudia, you know, I've worked with a father actually that was talking about end of life with his son, and he was denied cannabis in the hospital, and so he lost 4 weeks with his son, who had 8 weeks. And they finally allowed him to use cannabis, but he's doing something called Ryan's Law, and it's for the terminally ill allowed to use cannabis in hospitals, to defeat that pain. But like you, he went to our Senate and legislator and had unanimous, both sides of the aisle, that said, you're right, let's do it. And then our governor, Gavin Newsom, vetoed it, and it went, and it stuck because Gavin was... He wanted the cannabis vote. He got the cannabis vote. He's a, but so is that?
Because they're shysters, John. They're shysters. At the end of the day, they're politicians. Cannabis needs to be legal, period, end of story. We're having the same issue with Kratom. Kratom has not only helped addicts get off of heroin, but it's also been a lifesaver for pain patients. But we need to have the Safe Kratom Act so people know they're getting kratom from, a safe vendor. And I don't use kratom, but I support, if it works for you, then you should be able to access it. But the narrow-mindedness of some of these senators, they really believe it's that their thinking of cannabis is just so warped where they still think it's an evil drug, and I don't use cannabis. I tried some of the oils, but it made me a little loopy. And I have to fit a lot of hours in my day. But the fact that my pain patients can't use cannabis in combination with their opioids is lunacy, because it's the Controlled Substances Act that needs to be done away with. The Controlled Substances Act was created to stop the drug deals, for the cartel, but now it's used in the doctor's office, and it was just, it's low-hanging fruit, and the government, they're just so desperate to spread the false narrative. But I think that's what our government does, is they create this false narrative. The media jumps on board, and it becomes a real nightmare for both cannabis users and opioid users and kratom users. It's just a shame. What we do have going for us, and this is just a sliver of hope, is the AMA on June 18th put out a press release stating the AMA urges the CDC to revise opioid prescribing guidelines. And JAMA also put out a piece saying, you know what, prescribing is down, yet people are still overdosing. So those are two real powerful pieces without having to burden your lawmaker, because I'm really not impressed with most lawmakers that I sit down with. And sometimes I just don't even have the patience because they've been polluted by the media. And, you know, Senator Whitehouse, when I thought that.
My governor is a doctor. So there you go. It's true. I mean, Charlie Baker was very instrumental in the opiate.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, and because he works in tandem with Brandeis University.
Yes.
And Charlie Baker gets millions of dollars in federal grants from the makers of Suboxone, from buprenorphine. And how much money are the senators getting from pharmaceutical companies? How much are they donating to their campaign funds? So we're just in a time where you don't know what to believe. What's really sad is that if you're on a ventilator in North Carolina with COVID, there's a good chance your doctor will not keep you comfortable with opiates because they're afraid there's going to be an issue with dependency. We don't know what post-COVID brings. We don't know if scarring on the lungs is going to be an issue. What about this part of the community? Are they going to be able to receive medication? No, because the DEA implemented, manufacturers must make 30-40% less. We came into 2020, 40% less opioids in the country, and we urged our senators, please don't do this. If we have a catastrophic event, my senator laughed at me. He said, what kind of a catastrophic event would we have? Here you go, we're in a catastrophic event. And he said, well, we could always get medication from Massachusetts or Connecticut. We're all out of luck because the DEA ordered manufacturers to stop making, to slow down. And the only reason we were able to get that IV medication made is because 12 organizations, I think the American Cancer Society, they're big proponents. They said, look, we need more opiates. These people need to be sedated or they're going to pull out their breathing tube. And it's just one out of four people. You're going to get cancer. You're not going to get pain medication. So it's a fight, and we need the pain patients to get out there and protest. That's really all I can, other than being in everybody's state.
Yeah, is this what's happening in Rhode Island, pretty much what's happening in across our nation? I mean, is it the same laws out here? I mean, thank goodness I'm not in any pain. And so
it's actually, California has one of the best pain patient bill of rights in the country. But California Medical Board, probably the most unscrupulous medical board following Louisiana, they just target prescribers, period. They don't care if you're an oncologist, a rheumatologist, a neurologist, they're going after you. But it's the same. All 50 states have been equally attacked. And I do have patients that go to Guadalajara for medication. Yeah. I mean, what a country. Look. Welcome to America. You know, you can work, but you can't get your pain treated. And if you do, you got to pick your benzo or your pain medication. Which is more important? You know, not having debilitating anxiety or having the Vicodin that you need for your nerve pain.
You mentioned benzo. Can you give a definition of you said benzos or pain medication? Can you give a definition of benzos?
I'll let Beth take that one because she's the nurse.
Yeah, and why they help with pain. I mean, there's so many names in the pharmaceutical industry, and I'm not involved with that. I mean, thank goodness I'm not in any pain.
Yes, and that is, people that are not in pain should be grateful because you take that for granted. I know you don't, John, but people take it for granted and they can't imagine it because it's one of those things. You know, it's kind of akin to when I first got pregnant with my first daughter. I thought, holy cow, because this always happened to someone else. And then it happened to me. And so it was
what, a big got pregnant?
For me. I got pregnant, yeah. And I thought, wow, this is really, I'm gone. This is a big deal now. I'm going to, you know, it was a big deal. But it was like the type of thing that always happens to someone else. Well, chronic pain or intensely painful diseases, everyone thinks always happens to someone else, or you're always born with it. I'm here to tell you that it can happen to anyone. Anyone can have an accident, have their back subluxated, and now they're in spinal pain for the rest of their life. They can't walk. They have a walker. Anyone can come down with invisible diseases. Anyone can have develop proiliitis. There's all sorts of painful diseases that people have that really are incompatible with living. And yet, relief can just be a appropriate dose of opiates away. And the reasons why there's such a low rate of addiction, there's a difference between addiction and dependence. Dependence is when you need a medication to get through your day. So people are dependent on their antihypertensives. People are dependent on insulin. And insulin can be abused. People are dependent on all sorts of different medications in order to keep them in a state of health and get them through the day. Some people that have chronic pain are dependent on dosing of opiates, and that gets them through their day, and they work, and they're productive, and no one needs to know. But now they can't get their medication, and now they're crippled, and now they're in bed. So dependency, a typical chronic pain or severe pain patient does not get a euphoria from their pain medication. Let me just make that very clear. They do not get a euphoria. However, they may get a feeling of wellness because now they can move and they can get up and move around and they're not in crippling pain. Because pain tends to bring on more pain, as I described, tends to bring on more pain. An addict is someone that drug seeks without need, and it's illegal. So they're not taking legally prescribed drugs. They're taking drugs that they bought from someone off the street. And that is typically the influx from China and from down south, across the border, of opiates, heroin, very cheap, and fentanyl, the synthetic and illicit fentanyl. And so those are what's causing the overdoses, because they decrease the respiratory centers, and then you stop breathing. And that's why Narcan is the big hot button topic, because Narcan reverses that in a person. So when I worked in the ICU, you had somebody that was ventilator dependent and you wanted them to be quiet, you paralyze them. You paralyze them with a drug called Paxil. At the time, you would paralyze them. Whenever you paralyze someone, they would get morphine and Valium, and so or Ativan. So they'd get a pain medication and they'd get some sort of anti-anxiety. Because if they were to wake up and they can't move and you're breathing for them, that can, you know, they can be very impacted on that, but you don't know it because they can't talk because they're intubated. So what we would do is anytime patients started to move, typically their eyelids, they would need to be re-paralyzed again. You need to continuously give that. And so the type of care that goes on in the intensive care unit is beyond comprehension if you have not worked in an intensive care unit. You can't really, it's kind of like the type of thing you can't really understand it unless you are there seeing it, or you're there working in that environment, or the ER. What doctors have latitude. I mean, the doctors are the top of the food chain, and to think that we are going after our physicians at a very time for just writing prescriptions for appropriate opiate therapy, at a very time we're also calling upon them to find a cure for COVID or a vaccine is, to me, so hypocritical that on the one hand, the government's handcuffing them, literally and figuratively, but on the other hand, they're looking to them for answers for this horrible disease that we have, that we're all dealing with, this pandemic, is preposterous. And so I wanted to make sure that we had new, and I also wanted to say, what I always talk to Claudia about is, nobody realizes that when they talk about, oh, it's been flooded with pain pills since like 2012. Well, also, the use of hospice exploded during that time. People realized they had a Medicare benefit. If they had paid into Medicare, they could die at home and they could die comfortably. And those are called comfort meds. And to the extent that people want to be comfortable, that's the hospice's job, is to follow what their wishes are when they're admitted. So those things happen kind of in tandem with this whole issue that has gotten totally out of control.
Yeah. So you mentioned Ativan as well. So if you can give a brief definition on benzos, opioids, as well as Ativan, and do they fall into the same category?
No. So opiates are really, they ping on the pain receptors in the brain, where the benzos, the Ativans, decrease anxiety. Sometimes they can be used for seizure medication. But they can also be used, but sometimes chronic pain also gives people anxiety, or anxiety alone is torturous to people. And Claudia had, I believe, a physician, a psychiatrist, that all of his patients were taken off. He lost his patients. They were taken off their sedatives or their benzodiazepines. And there's a chance that they can seize if they go for a long time. You know, you have to ease off these type of medications. But what do you ease off to? Bacterial anxiety that prompted that first request for a script. But they can also be used for muscle relaxants. And a lot of people that are in chronic pain are very tight. So they can be used for muscle relaxants. They can be used for anxiety. They can be used to enhance sleep and all the things that they've been used for years and years and years. And one, they might enhance each other, but they certainly don't. I don't hear many pain patients that take both having any problem taking both.
What, like when well, you mentioned benzos for anxiety, and so what is that like? Again, I'm not familiar.
Like an Ativan or a Xanax, and then
Okay.
And then you have like Valium too, like the lorazepams, the diazepams. Those are a little bit of a different class, but they're also very powerful muscle relaxers, very powerful anti-anxiety assist, but people will build up a tolerance to them. That's one of the criticisms, that people can build up a tolerance and so their dose goes up. But that's all within the physician's scope of practice, is that they see these patients and they adjust accordingly. And if they see the patients taking too big of a dose, they have a conversation with the patient. It's not about the government jumping into this relationship and telling and arresting physicians, and then pain patients are left. Next thing you know, they're going through withdrawal and their pain is skyrocketing up and they are left with nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So where do they go? What do they do?
Is Ativan good for pain relief?
It can be. Benzos and muscle relaxers, sometimes a benzo paired with like Motrin or even like buffered aspirin or something can just do it for some patients for maybe a dose. But long-term pain, we're talking about chronic intractable pain here, that's not going to work for you. You might just be taking it for something else or to maybe enhance what you're taking. One of the things I do see about cannabis is that I think cannabis, for many people, can be exchanged for some of the benzos because they do have that, cannabis does have that relaxing, sedating, and, you know, depending on the type of cannabis and the ratios that you take. So I think that that's a very realistic opportunity. But I agree with Claudia. Whatever the patient needs to take, especially if it's plant-based and has been used for thousands of years, like kratom, should be allowed to be taken by anybody in the United States to mitigate their symptoms. It's criminal, really.
What do you say for the doctors or the people anti-opioids saying, because you always hear these pharmaceutical ads, and Corinne and I did an ad, a side-by-side ad with Lyrica. Lyrica versus cannabis.
Oh, doctors love their Lyrica, John.
You know, you see these side effects. And so what do you say about that when you see the side effects? Suicidal, but they always play them with some beautiful music. So you're kind of mesmerized with the pictures on the screen at the same time with the music and not hearing them say, you could have suicidal effects or liver damage or, everything.
Beth, can I answer this one?
Yeah,
go answer for it. Any question you want.
A lot of the patients, when they go to pain management centers, they're subjected to unnecessary, painful steroid injections, blocks, ablations. These patients have already been down that road. They're also subjected to gobbles of gabapentin, neurons, antidepressants, and then they're offered Suboxone. So what do we have? We have antidepressed Suboxonites walking throughout the country. Those drugs are not indicated to treat pain. There's zero evidence-based studies that say nerve pain gabapentin is effective, but antidepressants, this is another form of insanity, but the anti-opioid crusaders, they'll say, well, you've got gabapentin, you have injections, what more do you need? Unless you want to take our drug, buprenorphine. And it's always following the money. The way I explain this to a layperson is, if you're really depressed and you go to your psychiatrist and you say, I am so depressed, your psychiatrist is going to say, we're going to up your dose. But if you're in pain and you tell your pain doctor, I'm in pain, your doctor's like, oh, can't help you. CDC, I can only give you a certain amount of medication. Same with, lisinopril. If you're having high blood pressure, I can't get my blood pressure controlled. Well, we're going to up your dose. We're going to add some medications. That's not an option with narcotics, with opioids. Is you get what you get, and you don't get upset. And if you do, we're going to boot you from the clinic. Period. End of sentence. And the Human Rights Watch actually did an investigation about this, and that report also fell on deaf ears. But I think it was too soon, when this all happened 2 years ago. But now, more people are contacting their senators. They're like, enough is enough. I need to access medication. How will this change? First off, having a celebrity bring awareness like Annie Lennox did. And she just said, this is brutal. People with chronic pain can't get medication. We need a celebrity, but we really need 10 or 12 senators on a federal level go before Congress and say, this is an issue. People with pain can no longer receive medication. And we were sold a fake bill of goods when it came to the overdosing crisis. If prescribing is at an all-time low, why are people still overdosing? Because we never had a prescription pain medication issue. And when the DEA, this makes me laugh. I laugh every time I say it. When the DEA did their bring your medication, if everybody's gobbling up pain pills like Tic Tacs, why is there any medication to turn in? Because there isn't medication to turn in. It was never a crisis. We've never had an opioid pill problem. But I'll tell you what, your kid, if they think they're getting a Xanax from their friend, they've got about a 75% chance of overdosing, because it's going to have the illicit fentanyl in it, because these drug dealers, they are creative. They actually stamp their product. Kids can go online and say, "This, I got a great high from this. Give this drug dealer business." This is, we've actually spiked the overdosing crisis. Maybe that's what was supposed to happen. Maybe this has been a plan. I don't want to sound like some crazy conspiracy theorist, but you got to wonder what's going on Capitol Hill. What gives?
You mentioned kids, and I've heard, I don't have children, but you have.
Do you want one, John?
He have teenage.
But so what boys first, although they're men.
what about this stuff that we're hearing right now, where the kids are going into parents' cabinets, getting pills, and they put it almost like a Russian roulette. They put the pills in a thing, and people are pulling them out, not knowing what they're taking, and they're just taking.
Well, why are the kids? Let's address this. Why are the kids doing this? We live in a very sad world, right? Everybody is self-medicating with alcohol, with too many antidepressants, with too much weed. I don't want my kids get smoking weed. I'm a mom. When you're 18, you want to smoke weed, have at it. But you're a healthy person. You don't need to be, taking pills and smoking weed and drinking. When you're an adult, you make that decision. Under my roof, no candoozy. Not going to happen here. But why are we self-medicating? Because we live in a really sad place right now. Let's address the reason for addiction. And it's always going to go back to predisposition. My niece, my sister was adopted. My siblings were adopted. And my brother-in-law overdosed. But we raised my niece knowing, you can't drink, you can't smoke, because your dad was an addict. Let's have this discussion with our kids at home to hopefully slow down the overdosing. But the anti-opioid crusaders will have you believe this is all happening because of pill mills. Look, of course, there were some bad apples, right? Doctors were overprescribing. That fifth vital sign probably helped out a little with that, but it did not cause the opioid crisis. But when you see the media, 60 Minutes, have, interviewing doctors, this doctor prescribed 750,000 pills. How many patients did he have? Was he the only pain management center? That comes out to 4 pills a day for 3,000 patients. Okay. What? So what? But The other shocking thing, John, overdoses are going down as overdoses. You can have a heart attack, but if you have an opiate in your system, it's going down as an overdose. And that's how the doctors are getting tagged. And that's how those malicious medical boards, who, by the way, have qualified immunity. That's wrong. They're not God. The DEA has qualified immunity. They're not God. Not my God, anyway. Remove qualified immunity. And you won't be seeing doctors raid. You won't see those raids happen, because before a DEA goes barreling in with a gun held to the doctor, he's going to think, or she's going to think, oh, maybe I shouldn't do this. I could lose my home. That's another thing that needs to be addressed. There's a lot of things that need to be addressed.
Yeah, it is a big problem. And thanks for doing what you do. So for the patients that don't have access to this, their doctors are afraid to write the prescriptions to help these patients. Are there any good substitutes for benzos and opioids?
No. No, my patients are very, very sick.
That's why it's a crisis, because there actually are no. These are very specific, very, very old, well-used, well-understood, prescribed medications that have been used for years and years and years and years. We know how they work. They understand it. There's really no substitute. And I can tell you, just springboarding off the Lyrica, one of the reasons why antidepressants were used and became all the rage is because they want, obviously, not to use opiates, but in particularly the AIDS population, they were depressed. And when they took their depression, their medication, Elavil, started out with Elavil, they found that they had a side effect that it seemed to lift peripheral pain. But that's, so now all of a sudden, you have pain, you get an antidepressant. Well, those antidepressants have enormous side effects, especially if you're not depressed. It's not working on depression. It's working on pain, and you're being used. So for every antidepressant that I was prescribed, I was allergic to. So so many, many, many pain patients that take long-term opiate therapies actually have been through the mill with other modalities and have failed. So that's it, really. That's how it got started on the antidepressants.
So you mentioned that. Does it work for everyone? Like, cannabis doesn't work for everyone. And so is it sometimes trial and error when it comes to these pharmaceuticals, Claudia?
I think if you take an opiate and you're not in pain, it worked. Yeah. And that's pretty much how it goes. You know, a lot of people take a pain pill and say, oh, that made me, you know, my mom, something about the generation. My mom's 84, and she fell down the stairs, broke her back, broke her neck. She broke things I didn't know could be broken. But that woman was horribly sick when they tried to give her pain medication. And it was the decision of myself and my mom's, you know, and I handled her pain with acetaminophen and ibuprofen, and I did her physical therapy, and I took care of her. Because I don't, you know, she didn't react the same way I reacted to pain medication in the hospital. But, you know, healthcare should be individualized. It's between the doctor and the patient, not the doctor, the patient, the attorney general, the DEA, and the medical board. And that's what we have to reinstill. I have a nonprofit, the Doctor Patient Forum. And that's how we're able to help people. Myself and a retired doctor will get on the phone and we'll say, okay, let's start from the beginning. Do you have a primary care physician? Probably not, because if you're a chronic pain patient, most primary care physicians will not even take you as a patient. So it's another attack. But, you know, we just want to be sure patients have had the proper workup. What's their diagnosis? And if we can help them, we will. And if you can manage your pain without a narcotic, great. But it's, you know, when you're a veteran and you fight and you go to war for us and you have a leg and an arm blown off, why should you have to fight for your pain medication and your benzodiazepine? Why is this an issue? This should not even be a conversation. You know, it's, and I was on the Dr. Drew show when we spoke about this, but if you're an anti-opioid zealot, it's, you know, you're a zealot. And I think for a lot of these anti-opioid crusaders, this started off as a cause for them because they lost a loved one, but their cause has stoked the pain patient genocide. And it's like, enough. Like, how much pain are you going to bring to another community in an effort to heal your pain?
Well, they don't know it until they're truly affected. Like I said, if it's with them or someone in their circle. Before we get off, I receive a lot of emails from a lot of these companies from up in Canada that will set you can order all these pills online. Is that what this is? You know, what a lot of people are doing now because they're one fearful that they're not being that their doctor's not going to prescribe them a medication.
No, you can't get a doctor to prescribe in Canada.
So are these companies safe or is it scary? I mean, are they? Is it just a pill that has a stamp on it? Is there any way? Are these real companies that are doing these?
I don't think you can get opiates in people at all. And just so that you know, what also is very interesting, Walmart will not give anybody a discount, GoodRx, on any opiate that they choose to fill with a legal prescription. They will cut you down. The pharmacist has been empowered to reduce the amount of opiates that you can get at a single fill. And they've been over a physician's prescription, which actually has always been a felony because they're practicing medicine. So now you have pharmacists that are stepping in and they're refusing to fill a physician's order. So there are all sorts of ways that pain patients are shamed because of something that happened to them. That for the most part, they had the misfortune of having this happen to them. And there are many, many ways they're embarrassed. I had a very dear friend who died of cancer, and he had been a hero. He had been considered a hero in firefighting, and he was having a lot of pain, and it was the first time he ever had to fill his OxyContin. And he said he was embarrassed because he felt, they commented on it. There are now times you have to actually put down in your prescription what the ICD-10 code is, why you're in pain, and so that everybody in the pharmacy can understand all of your diseases that cause you pain for some reason, because they're tracking you. But this gentleman, not only was he facing his end of his life as a young man, but he was so humiliated by what he went through in the pharmacy that he came to me and he said, "You have no idea. I mean, I felt like I had to say to everybody, I have cancer, because they all looked at me like I was a drug addict, and I never took a drug in my life." So that's the type of stories that we hear, and it's heartbreaking, and there's nothing to be done. Once you've lost your doctor, and once you've lost your prescriptions, guess what? You're gonna detox off your, and then you are gonna be in raging pain, and that's when people kill themselves.
And you're on your own. That's sad. Claudia, you mentioned, offline about a class action lawsuit. Are you interested in getting into that right now, or is that a topic you don't want to talk about right now?
Oh, no, I don't mind. So, my partner, Dr. Feldman, reached out to an attorney in West Virginia. Ironically, this attorney also was the plaintiff's attorney in the big tobacco lawsuit years ago, his family. And there's now, I think, four, maybe five law firms on board. And they're suing CVS. I interview a doctor every few weeks on my podcast, and I interviewed a pharmacist the other night, and he said, it's despicable. He said, no, nobody should be doing that, but it's Walgreens' internal policy, which is about this big, right? To tell a patient it's their policy to not fill it. So if you say, why won't you fill it? They'll say, well, it's our policy. And you'll say, well, can I see the policy? They'll say, we can't show you the policy because it's our policy. But is it legal? Isn't that tampering with a controlled substance script? And it took us a year to really educate these attorneys about it because they didn't know about it. But I think the class action lawsuit will put this issue on the map. Sadly, this country responds to only litigation. And when you have the pantsuit off of you, that's when a light bulb is going to go on. And same with the doctors. While I support providers and I work with them, I'll be the first to take a bad one out. And if you're pumping my patient with injections they don't need and all this other medication, while you're dangling a small daily script over their head, you're going to lose your license, because these are all wrong things. I represent the underdog. I don't like to see people being attacked and belittled. And that's why this is, you know, everybody has a cause. This is my cause.
Well, thank you for that, Claudia. And thank you, Beth, as well. And can, on closing words, do you want to add anything that you're doing right now besides this class action lawsuit, but your website, how they can find you and what you're doing, not only in Rhode Island, but nationwide and worldwide?
Right. So the best thing for a patient to do is join the Facebook page, Don't Punish Pain Rally. Start organizing your protest October 7th. Send the link to the AMA. The AMA just put out that very powerful statement. Send that to your lawmakers. Call up, schedule meetings with your local people. Those people want those seats. Make them work for those seats. Make them earn it. And hopefully 60 Minutes will pick up our side of this. It's a lot of work. We need national media. So we just encourage people, stay on top of it. Get on Twitter, be active. And if they need help, they can find me at the Doctor Patient Forum.
Great. And Beth, you want to add to that?
What Claudia said.
What Claudia said.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, ladies, I can't thank you enough for being on and sharing this. And Claudia and Beth, if there's anything that I can do or United Patients Group can do, we're a patient advocate as well. And there's a lot of times when patients come to us, I route them away from cannabis. You know, I say, you know, I've seen higher success rates with this versus this. And it kind of surprises them because they say, well, you're a cannabis company. Yeah, but my number one goal is being a health advocate, and what I've seen success in as well. And like you, taking the stance this is the passion that Crit and I started. You know, cannabis was not our lifestyle, but we were kind of adopted and I won't say forced in this industry, but I've seen this work and I've seen other things work. And so again, you know, that's who makes me, but that's why we do what we do. So Claudia Morandi, thank you so much for being on. Beth Doss, thank you so much for being on and your support over the years as well. And we will see you both soon. This is John Malanka with the United Patient Group. Be informed and be well. Bye-bye.